Allen, can I nominate the whip?
I will second.
Can I second?
2 seconds, but can I just ask that, can't we take a decision, if we are quorated, that when the chairman is here, not for the next meeting, the whip will stand in?
Mr. Kurov, the decision will be so noted. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much once more, members, for showing confidence in me, according me these few hours I meant to officiate over this important city. A special welcome, Honorable Tibetana, please don't distract me. A special welcome to our guest from, what's the list? From National Treasury, the list of this, as well as our guest from FSB and from National Treasury, of course. I was trying to refer to Momo, and we have obviously our people from tax, the financial sector, and also our representative from the parliamentary legal side. Special word of welcome also to Janine, who was working on the legal aspect in the legal division. Members, this is a team that was with us just recently when we held what we refer to as a workshop, a very fruitful session indeed. Now today they are here as dictated by our program to then present the feedback that emerged as a result of the public hearings that were conducted. And from there, as we are all aware, as a committee, we are expected then to adopt the version of the two bills for further processing by the House. Now, as we have said in our last engagement, I mean, even in the workshop, it came out very clear that the financial crisis that the world finds itself in has made us to pick up some few lessons globally. And one of the key lessons that has been picked up by global economies is the fact that our financial structures, but also our regulatory structures must be up to date and must exhibit a potential that will ensure that we are able to survive this moment. What is also compounding matters is the fact that most of the so-called big economies are not doing well. And we are viewed as South Africa as a country that is having a potential. I mean, to obviously provide opportunities for business, you know. So as a result, then, I think we are on course as the legislative sector to make sure that we regulate sufficiently so as we stand a better chance, of course, of providing these opportunities out of our country. But also the other thing that is a big challenge is that we are currently participating in international forums. We are in the BRICS, we are all over. We are in the G20, we are all over. And it's expected of us to comply to the standard of international what we call participation. And I'm definitely sure that after our workshop last time, all of us are convinced that this is a task that we are not going to shirk on. This is a task that we are going to perform, of course, give it our best. And I think we all agree that we must move very, very cautiously, but expeditiously, because if we move from these two bills, I mean, to the Twin Peaks architecture as well as the amendment bills, it's very clear that we have a lot of work to do to ensure that we are at least, I mean, regarded as people who are ready, I mean, to take advantage of the envisaged opportunities out of our country. I think we still remember that we still have the Banks Amendment bill, that we need to do the Financial Services General Laws Amendment bill, the insurance law amendment bills that we still need to do. So that simply says we still have a lot of work to do. And for some of us, we are expected to make sure that we bend the midlight lamp. I mean, so as we are able to give the necessary political direction to this process as people who are expected to make legislation. So that simply says, members, we are on course. And today, as I've indicated, we are here to get the feedback from the cited stakeholders around the submissions that were made by during the public hearings. So without any further ado, I'm going to accord Momo an opportunity and then to obviously take us through. Obviously, he will determine whom of his team will be obviously assisting in the process. Momo, welcome, and this is an opportunity that is accorded to yourself.
Thank you, Chair, for inviting us. And can I just say, I think though you've seen our team, I think from the Treasury we've got Roy Haberman, who's just been promoted, is now Chief Director, no longer acting, for Financial Markets and Stability. We've got Kathy Dixon, who has done a lot of the hard work on this. Gibson. Did all the hard work and then decided to do other things, get the number two to look after, baby, I mean. But she's still with us, and Janine, who you've acknowledged. And then we've also got our colleagues from the FSB. I don't know if Rita wants to just say who's here.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Rita Stander from the Legal Department, and my colleague Shamila Keshav from the Capital Markets Department, Norman Miller from also the Capital Markets Department, Scott Sully from the Market Abuse Department, and Roland Cooper, you will remember from last week, will talk on credit rating agencies. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. So, Chair, I think you've outlined I think what we're here for, essentially, I think, obviously this bill is out. I think you've put the context of the global crisis and some of the bills that are coming. And as you've pointed out, I think there's going to be a number of bills that come through. You haven't exhausted the list. I think a lot of the legislation needs to be updated. And let me say up front that none of this legislation is also dealing with all the challenges that are still to come. So even when we look at the financial markets bill, we are in a situation where we do need to amend it, even for the transition. But to the extent that there are still issues, we've had to decide whether you regulate that as and when it happens, because internationally there's a lot of discussions, for example, on derivatives and what the powers of regulators should be. There are international standards and so on that apply. So it is, a very specific sector in how we deal with it. Our approaches, we hope, are in line with what's done in markets internationally and particularly those that we deal with. I think what's important, of course, is to get the South African perspective through, and in this bill we've gone through that process. Now, we received, you can put the slides on, obviously now that we have to put it into a form of a bill, and you will see that the regulators and the minister have a lot of powers to regulate or issue directives, and Advocate Jenkins has come in on some of those issues. And I should add that those are issues that's going to guide a lot of our future legislation as well. What we've done, therefore, is we've given you a document. It doesn't say draft, but it is a draft response document. And even as we speak, we still get phone calls on one or two areas that will come back to you where people have concerns and that we are resolving. We think they're pretty close to being resolved so that we can still stick to the deadline, but we will alert you to those. And just to make life simpler for you, this is not an official bill, but we've tried to track the changes against the original table bill so that you can see exactly what changes are envisaged. Again, this will change after today's hearing, although we don't hope it will change too much. If we find consensus, I think the majority of changes clearly clarify the policy intention, and we don't believe that there's substantive issues. I think that there are technical issues, and often the way things have been nuanced, it has to be amended. We received, as you saw, 15 comments on this bill, which I think kind of indicates that this bill is complex, and there's only a very small grouping of people who feel that they can and should comment on the bill, even though it's been widely available. Often the comments do come from industry associations, so that they do represent some form of consensus within different constituencies. The issue, of course, is there may be differences between the different constituencies, and that's what we need to often play the role of Solomon here and decide the way forward. Okay. So I think just to remind ourselves, I think there's been this extensive consultation. There was a review done in 2009-11. The draft bill was published last year. There were comments received. The bill was again tabled in May, if I remember, was right, and there's been lots of consultative workshops, including with the committee last week. Move on. Okay. Okay, and this is just the formal process, and So I think just let's get into the heart of the matter, okay? We're going to go through, Chair, therefore, all the comments. Now, the draft document does go through almost on a clause by clause, the points that have been raised by various players and how we as a Treasury are responding. We've had a working group with the FSB and other players, so so that they often do represent consensus. I'm not saying they always represent some consensus, but to the extent there are material differences, we will bring that to your attention. So, Roy, do you want to just go through all the, or does Janine want to go through all the definitional changes?
Okay.
So, Chair, the presentation will just highlight what we think are the big changes. This does represent in more detail. It's a working document, just to help the committee to see how we've taken comments into account. But it's not necessarily exhaustive in the sense that when there are technical changes, I think really one needs to see it in the bill. But it explains most of it.
Thank you. I think, Chair, I think I'll give Janine the opportunity to take us through the definitions. I think most of them are quite straightforward in terms of the small changes to the definitions from stakeholders. So Janine will do that, and then Chapter 2 and onwards, I'll ask Kathy to do it, and then I will deal, I think, with the clearinghouse section and the clearing issues.
Thank you very much. Just to cover a few of the key definitions that were referred to in the submissions presented to the committee. It was noted in respect of the definition of prescribed by the minister that it should clearly indicate that there would need to be publication in the Gazette in respect of matters prescribed by the minister, and we certainly agree with that, so we are clarifying that in the proposed amendments. And then it was indicated in some submissions that perhaps the definition of central securities account that was contained in the bill was perhaps somewhat too broad, but we've carefully considered that matter and the overall role of that definition within the legislation, and we've come to the determination that we think that the definition as it currently provides, it is appropriate and it does play the appropriate role within the legislation. So we are recommending that that definition should not be amended. In respect of the definition of derivative instrument, it has been noted that since the bill was originally published for public comment, at the international level, there has been some developments in how the definition of derivative instrument is defined, and so we are proposing some slight amendments in order to align it with the developments in the international standards. So we are endeavoring to ensure that we're keeping the legislation aligned with international definitions and understandings as far as possible. And it was proposed that we should include perhaps a definition of juristic person in the bill, and we are agreeing with that proposal, and we are proposing to include the insertion of a definition of juristic person. And in respect of the definition of nominee that was contained in the published version of the bill, the tabled version of the bill, rather, it was proposed that the definition could clarify that it refers to regulated nominees, and so we agree with that proposal, and we are proposing a refinement to the definition to respond to that. And in respect of the definition of securities, submissions were made that money market securities should be dealt with and recognized as a special category of securities, and we agree with that, and we are referring to them specifically in the definition. And it was also requested that the Reserve Bank's share capital and trading in its own shares should be excluded from the ambit of the definition of securities, and we have agreed with that proposal. So we have proposed slight refinements to the definition of securities to address those proposals. And then in relation to the definition of this act, in relation to the credit rating services bill, we had some engagements with the committee and also with the parliamentary legal advisor regarding the appropriate scope of definition of this act, and so we are proposing the inclusion of a definition of this act in this bill that is in line with the discussions we have had and would be in line with what would be included in the credit rating services bill. So I think that covers the next slide. Okay. And in respect of the definition of insolvency proceeding, it was noted that the definition should clarify that insolvency should commence on filing, and so we agree with that proposal, and we have proposed an appropriate refinement to the definition. And in respect of execution venue, it was proposed that the definition should potentially allow for certain other execution venues, and this is something that we are of the view needs to have some thorough consideration. So we are not proposing that that should be addressed at this stage, but we will bear that in mind in future and possibly in future legislative amendments that might be addressed. In respect of the definition of market infrastructure, we have ensured, we are proposing to include a definition of market infrastructure that ensures that all of the various entities in the markets are appropriately defined, and it provides a better overall coherence in the regulatory framework by the inclusion of this definition. In respect of a definition of interdealer broker, we are proposing that there be a definition, or that they are different from ordinary stockbrokers and they should be treated slightly differently from other stockbrokers, and so we have agreed that was that proposal, and in the bill we are making provision that they are appropriately recognized and will able to be appropriately regulated in accordance with the functions that they are performing. And in respect of the definition of regulated person, we have proposed some slight extensions of the definition of regulated person to align with a new section, clause 5, subclause 1, that would be included in the bill to provide for a regulatory provision for the minister in terms of clause 5.1 to ensure that all persons who are conducting security services will be appropriately regulated. And then the definition of external parties, we are proposing that it would be amended slightly to ensure that the term is appropriately clear and concise. And in respect, Roy, are you wanting to go with this? Okay, sure.
Changes to the object of the Act. There was a proposal that we specifically include competition as an object of the Act. Currently, the bill deals with ensuring competitive security services. I think Treasury felt that was sufficient, and there is also the potential for overlap between the Financial Markets Bill and the Competition Act, and so it was felt that we should rather leave the two regulatory arms to deal with the issues separately. Then moving along to Chapter 2, I'm going to ask Kathy to take us through. These are mainly rearrangements, so we've moved things from Section 77 to Section 5, but Kathy will explain what has been done there.
Thank you, Chair and Roy. Chair, I'm going to proceed with the presentation, but I know that we are under time constraints, so I will try to move through quickly, especially given the detail that we did last week. If, however, I'm going too slowly or too quickly, too much detail, too little, please advise. Thank you. I think there just needs to be, to make sure that you all understand core changes, well, not changes, but restructurings made into the bill. That definition of market infrastructure, as you would have seen last week in terms of our discussion has largely replaced the term self-regulatory organization. This does not mean we no longer have self-regulatory organizations, and we had an extensive discussion last week about what an SRO was and what that means and what a market infrastructure is and what that means. But just to clarify then that for your understanding, an exchange, a CSD, a central securities depository, a clearinghouse, a trade repository, all these entities are market infrastructure. Of those, exchange, CSD, and a clearinghouse would have regulatory functions. A trade repository will not. Moving then on to chapter two, changes here are generally not in response to comments, but rather response to internal discussions that we have had around the structuring of the legislation or the proposed bill. We have introduced a Section 5, which centralizes the powers of the minister, which were spread across the bill into a single section. Section 1 would be the previous Section 77, which deals with the minister's power to issue regulation around unlisted securities. Section 5.3, also not new, that dealt with the regulation around external participation in our markets. A new clause is Section 5.2, and this is in response to concerns that were raised around players which we had not necessarily named in terms of the bill, and as such perhaps couldn't extend our regulatory oversight over those players. And an example that we gave last week here were trading in contract for difference contracts. And this is just one example of, in an evolving market, we can't name everything in terms of the bill. Therefore, we want to create the flexibility that if there is an emerging market segment, we can reach that segment. In terms of Section 6, that deals with powers of the registrar. The Section 6.6 is not new. That was formerly in the Section 77 and has been moved, also dealing with unlisted. So in other words, with your OTC derivative instruments, those will be subject to regulation issued by the minister, and then the registrar would impose the detail of what the requirements would be for the trading of those instruments. There is a different accommodation for how the registrar and governor would interact. Previously, you would see in the May version of the bill, there were references to the governor in terms of the licensing applications, that the registrar and governor would need to issue those licenses jointly, as well as systemic risk, the reporting of systemic risk by regulated persons. This has been changed to ensure a clearer line of responsibility so that those who are reporting to the registrar would report on matters of systemic risk into the registrar and not the governor. And building from that, though, the registrar and governor would need to have arrangements in place to monitor, to identify, monitor, and manage and mitigate systemic risk. And that's what the new Section 6.3.0 is intended to allow for. If we move on to then Chapter 3, exchanges, what you will see in most of these clauses here, these were clauses or proposals that were raised in the comments regarding the market infrastructure as the self-regulating market infrastructure. And just a reminder that self-regulating does not mean that the exchange regulates itself. It means that it regulates the market that it is servicing or providing for. And so you'll see, for example, where in Section 8, Section 10, we have said all market infrastructure, these are similar clauses which have been applied across the market infrastructure. For that reason, when we move on to those infrastructures, I won't repeat the explanation as to why we've introduced them, and we'll simply explain them on this slide and move forward on that to avoid repetition. So Section 8.1b is a new provision. A concern was raised that there's no principle of good governance that is captured for the market infrastructure. our view, why we had not included this previously, is that as a licensed entity, market infrastructure, like in this instance an exchange, has got a number of functions which it is obligated to perform, and those functions give effect to governance. However, we agree that this is a sound principle, and we have accordingly introduced it. Under the functions of an exchange, the principle of fairness and transparency, this had initially been included as a function, but a function is something which an entity is required to perform, and it doesn't make sense within that context, so we have accommodated this principle as a principle up front, that an exchange must abide by this principle, and likewise this is applied across all the market infrastructure. The integrated clearing model, this talks through what we had partly discussed last week around the fact that in South Africa clearing can happen in different ways. It can either happen as part of the exchange CSD function, it could happen as a standalone clearinghouse, and it could happen by a clearinghouse which is linked to an exchange. In this bill, we have not imposed a model of what is appropriate and what is not. However, what we have insisted upon is that there, irrespective of the model, there should be a similar or an equivalent standard. And those Section 10.2J and 17.2S in the revised bill is accommodating exactly that and making sure that there is equivalence within and for an exchange that is providing clearing functions. Then insolvency proceedings, the notification of insolvency proceedings, this relates in part to the definition that Janine had spoken about and the issue of when does the insolvency proceeding begin, and it is indeed upon filing, and that change is inserted in an earlier section, and linked to that clause are these respective notifications of insolvency proceedings that when an insolvency proceeding is brought against a market infrastructure, in this case an exchange, it must notify the registrar immediately. Under the exchange rules, there were concerns raised that for users of the exchange, that there was no set process as to how complaints could be brought against the exchange, and when those complaints should appropriately be escalated to the registrar. And we have, as a result, provided for a complaints mechanism. It must be noted that a user of the exchange can at any time approach the registrar's office, but this is at least providing for a paper trail, as it were, and improves the accountability of the market infrastructure in terms of how it does deal and interface with its users. Section 17.2W, again, this deals with the accountability of the SROs. You will know from previous sessions that, generally speaking, one of the most significant concerns has been that a self-regulatory organization is given much power and authority over its users, and therefore we need to increase accountability of those institutions. And so the complaints mechanism is one way of increasing that accountability. Transparent pricing is another way of increasing that accountability, and provides that the exchange must show how it is reaching the prices that it is charging to its users. Likewise, this extends to other market infrastructure as well. There is a new Section 17.2CC and DD. This is dealing with the interdealer brokers. As Janine has indicated, there is a new provision which defines what an interdealer broker is. And these provisions here provide for an exchange to make rules for interdealer brokers, recognizing the role that they are playing in the market as matching buyers and sellers and the significance that that implies. There was, as we discussed last week, a discussion around when is an exchange, and is interdealer broker an exchange. We've said no, it isn't, provided that it is registered as an authorized user. If interdealer broker wants to be responsible for the final transaction or that final transaction event, it would need to be licensed. So what we're doing here is we're filling a gap and making sure that there aren't any gaps in terms of the legislation. Moving on to custody and administration of securities, Chapter 4. issues were raised with the segregation of securities. These were more on clarifications, and the question was asked about in terms of holding securities in an account. Segregation mean that they have to, that if I'm holding a security on behalf of someone else, that my accounts have to be separate from that entity's, that my securities have to be separate in terms of a separate account. The answer is yes, at least. And in fact, what we spoke about last week was what does segregation mean, and what we are talking about is that a security must be identifiable, but it must also be separate. So not only must, if I'm holding other person's securities, my securities must be separate from those securities, but also those securities must be separated from each other. In terms of the functions of a CSD, a concern was raised regarding the CSD's jurisdiction in relation to certificated securities. Just keeping in mind that securities can either, you can have the certificate which says I own this security, or otherwise it can be in the dematerialized form, which is residing with Strait as the CSD. And a concern was raised that Strait, in fact, doesn't have jurisdiction over the certificated environment. However, what Section 32M provides for is in the instance where an entity or person volunteers to have their certificated instrument with Strait, they are allowed to do so, even if not compelled to do so. And therefore, Strait has to be empowered in those instances to impose rules and requirements, and that's what the intention of that section is. So it is correct. There was a question around the enabling of link-up with an external CSD, and what this is talking about is that we have an external central securities depository which can enter into directly into our markets as a participant in Strait and our CSD. And there were concerns in the wording here whether Strait as our local CSD might be competing with local participants, and whether they would be introducing custody and settlement risk by allowing this external participant into our markets. The wording within Section 32T makes clear that Strait will not ever be competing with its participants. It might be holding some of those securities, but it would never be holding those securities for itself. It would be holding them on behalf of a participant, and the wording is just to give effect to that. In terms of the custody and settlement risk, we will not be allowing external participation without significant regulatory oversight and impact assessment, and that will take part in terms of the 5.3, which is the minister powers to issue regulation about external participation in our markets, and it is not going to be allowed literally overnight either. There's a process of engagement which needs to take place to make sure that we have adequately dealt with the risks that could be introduced. Conflicts of interest. This is has been an ongoing issue from the beginning of the process, whereby in the Security Services Act, there was not a clear distinction between the function that a market infrastructure performs compared to services which the user of that infrastructure would perform. In an earlier version, well, in our Financial Markets Bill, we do clearly make that distinction. So in other words, if you are a CSD, if you are an exchange, you cannot provide a service which competes with an authorized user or participant, as the case might be. That principle is further entrenched within the context of the bill, and Section 32S and T give a further extension to that as well. And under the pledge or cession of securities, pledging and cession refers to the instance where a pledge is where you want to give, in order to proceed with the transaction, you are giving some rights away to a security that you hold, but you retain some of those rights. A cession is where you give all the rights away, and you could be thinking of as a transfer of ownership. There were two issues here. One dealt with the question of to secure a debt and whether that was the appropriate term. You'll see that there's a Latin in securitatum debiti, and I have no idea whether I pronounced that correctly or not, but the issue was that whether we want to use plain English or not. The concern was that, well, actually we all know what in securitatum debiti means. To secure a debt might, even if in using plain English, this is not appropriate in this context, and we've reverted back then to the Latin. Having said that, in our bill we provide for pledge and cession. The consequence of a pledge is that you need to flag when a pledge has been made. In other words, if you've given some rights of your security over, you can't then re-pledge those same rights to someone else. And to guard against that, you have to flag that there has been already a transfer or a pledge of those rights. Now, on the other hand, a cession is where you would, as I say, effectively sell a security. It's not selling, but it effectively is. And that would potentially result in a tax. It would be a tax event. So what you see in our markets, and currently in the bill, what it says is that it either provides for this pledge or the cession. So now the current market practice does something in between this. They don't call it a pledge, and they don't call it a cession, but effectively they are transferring all rights, but they want to avoid the tax, so they don't call it a cession, and they don't want to have to do the flagging, so they don't call it a pledge. And the proposal is that we included something, some other name that would allow you to get around both of these impositions. Our view is that that is not appropriate. You either are transferring all the rights, in which case you are subject to the tax. I think that tax is not appropriate, and we will then be, as a result, engaging with the tax unit to make sure that that tax event is not triggered unless you land up holding that, unless the security is transferred on an ongoing going forward. However, if the security is transferred, it transferred back again, there shouldn't be a tax trigger. But that is it's a tax issue. It's not an issue here. So we don't want to be creating new things in our law to give effect to a problem that's actually caused elsewhere. As a result, we are retaining the clauses as they are. If we move then on to Chapter 5, I think Roy will... I think I've missed out. Chapter 4.
Do you want to say something on the tax treatment? I mean, basically, I think as Cathy has said, we won't... There's basically no change to the section, but the changes that were highlighted in the comments are incorporated in the amendments to the Taxation Law Amendment Bill, Chair, that is also on the cards at the moment. So we have tried to do the amendments so that they fit together.
I think we also should make the point that what we don't want, even though we believe that this is legally the correct way to, within the structure of the law, this is the correct way to go, we don't want to lead to a disruption in the market. So we, to the extent that it's appropriate, we will provide a temporary exemption for these existing practices in the interim so that we can iron out how to manage them going forward. Then looking at the flagging I've already dealt with, and then these are the general provisions which I've already spoken to. These are the new insertions that I've indicated and discussed under the exchange. So there's a principle of good governance, principle of fairness and transparency, insolvency proceedings and transparent pricing. That is not under the same clause. But you'll see the transparent pricing, there are a number of different provisions which are affected by those changes, and in the process for complaints as well. Moving on then to the clearinghouse section, and Roy will take you through.
Thank you very much, Cathy, and thank you very much, Chair. The concern was raised under clearinghouse that the South African market is too small to justify a fully-fledged central counterparty, and as we explained last week, we are required under the G20 commitments to have... we are not required to have a central counterparty. We are required to ensure that as far as possible or as appropriate, OTC transactions are cleared through a central counterparty. And so particularly since the majority of transactions might be between South African counterparties and foreign banks, and foreign banks may actually have requirements to clear offshore. And then there are concerns raised in the process that the Basel III capital and margining requirements need to be in by January 2013. And it's not sure clear if a domestic central counterparty would be there by that time. And also there was concern raised about the potential extraterritoriality of Dodd-Frank and the European requirements. That's, these are the same two requirements that have affected the credit rating services bill and are thinking about that. So in terms of that, we have made very small changes to the bill to allow essentially for three different approaches. And I just want to be clear that this was the original proposal, but I think there was a little bit of confusion about the wording, and so we've just clarified the wording. Essentially, this will allow for an external clearinghouse, which will have to pass an equivalence test, and the equivalence test would therefore would be determined on an international level, and the equivalence requirements are those that will be set out by particularly Basel, but also by IOSCO. It will also allow for the registration of a foreign clearinghouse in South Africa, and it will also allow for a domestic clearinghouse. We already have some existing domestic clearinghouses, so these three options are available to clearinghouse participants. In addition, the same proposal as Cathy has highlighted in terms of general provision, so there's also a process for complaints by clearing members against the CSD in respect of the exercise of functions. Then in respect of a trade repository, similar concerns were raised that defining it as a company incorporated in terms of the Companies Act effectively excludes an application from an external TR. We would, as far as possible, like external international trade repositories to register with the Financial Services Board so that they can ensure that trade reporting is done appropriately. And so we have changed that to make it firstly subject to the regulations prescribed by the minister, but also the juristic person which Janine dealt with. And then the minister may prescribe which requirements to what extent an applicant must comply with. And then section 54.1 and 57.2b deal with decisions made on trade repositories with wide policy impact will be subject to minister regulation. That previously, if I'm correct, was to the registrar's discretion, but after interactions with Advocate Jenkins, the view was taken that we should ensure that this is in subordinate legislation, so it will be part of the ministerial regulations. And then I think I've dealt with these issues also under the central counterparty. We're essentially allowing for the same three options, an external trade repository or registration of a foreign trade repository in South Africa. That would be an equivalent test, or a local trade repository solution.
Moving on then to Chapter 7, this chapter largely reflects the change which I had introduced at the beginning, where that term self-regulatory organization has been replaced by market infrastructure. This is correct because all SROs are market infrastructure. Not all market infrastructure are SROs. Again, as I had indicated or in the beginning, highlighted in the beginning. So these provisions do apply to all market infrastructure. The most significant change in the Financial Markets Bill in this light relative to the Security Services Act is the introduction of a trade repository, which does not necessarily, well, which will not be an SRO. Going forward, there is also a question about the separation of the regulatory versus the commercial activity or functions that a market infrastructure is expected to perform, and that will form part of that discussion, the debate on the appropriate SRO model for South Africa going forward. Under this section then, there were broadly three issues. One was three main issues, but there are a couple of others as well, which I'll discuss. The first is with regard to the license renewal, that the existing provisions provided that for a market infrastructure, you needed to annually renew that license. This was envisaged historically to be that if you weren't performing your functions or doing what you were supposed to, that license could be withheld. Practically speaking, I think this is agreed that it's a blunt instrument that introduces a cumbersome renewal process without giving the protection which it is supposed to do. And so we agree with commentators, and as a result have changed the renewal to an annual license assessment. And this will then also be supported with the various components of the license have not been adequately dealt with. There are other mechanisms that the registrar has available to him or her to hold that market infrastructure to account, in particular by referring contraventions through to the enforcement committee for sanction. On the conflict of interest, as I'm sure you are well aware by now, this again reflects what I have already referenced as being one of the major concerns across this process, which has been the conflict of interest that market infrastructure faces in terms of having both commercial and regulatory role. And therefore we have further increased accountability and strengthen the conflict of interest provisions. Just to remind, this conflict of interest provision is a new addition from the Security Services Act, and in this iteration of the bill, we have further strengthened those provisions. So what we have done is indicated that there will be detailed requirements to manage conflict of interest as will be prescribed by the registrar. We felt that it was inappropriate, as some commentators suggested, to impose or bring those actual requirements into the bill, because those standards will be changing and evolving over time, and this gives flexibility to the registrar to make sure that those standards are kept pace with. Those standards will be subject to assessment by the market infrastructure, and that assessment will be made public. What this means is that the users of the market infrastructure will be able to have visibility as to whether that infrastructure if the assessment is saying it is living up to the standard or not, and where it is viewed that there is a discrepancy between what the assessment is saying and what market users believe to be the case, they can at least be able to see that and be able to further hold the entity to account by approaching either the entity itself or through the complaints mechanism, as you know, or otherwise approach the registrar directly. Further on the conflicts of interest, the additional business clause, which is section, I think it'll be the new section 61, will also... It does deal with the conflicts of interest. It's another element to the conflicts of interest. And what the additional business clause is doing is it requires that if you, for an entity, a market infrastructure that is going to do additional business that goes beyond what its core function is, that it can't be in competition or undermine its users in any way. We've introduced a new clause which also prohibits any additional business which may introduce systemic risk. There were comments relating to what's referred to as the Security Ownership Register. It's a central register at the level of the CSD Strait. And this also relates to the definition that was spoken to earlier about the Central Securities Account. And at issue here is that within that definition, that the CSD can make rules that for the participant, an external CSD, and some other element or some other person. That person, it was concerned that it would allow the CSD to compete with the participants. That provision is necessary to ensure a central register. And just to be clear, a central register is when that record of ownership is actually at the level of the CSD, and it will be a live record of ownership. So as the trading is happening, as settlement is happening, it will be recorded not at these lower levels but in the CSD itself, and that means a much better visibility of ownership in real time, which is good to assist with efficiencies and managing systemic risk. So we think it's a good thing. We do not allow for, just to be clear, we are not allowing for the CSD to compete with its participants. That's not what these clauses are doing. What it again, what I'd spoken to earlier was that even if a CSD is holding securities in at the CSD level, which it needs to do to have the central register, it will be doing so on behalf of its participants. It can never be doing it as a participant itself. So in other words, we disagree with that comment, and we think it is already addressed and that the law is clear. Vertical integration, this was a general concern around the integrated nature of the market infrastructure, in particular what Roy had discussed to some extent last week, which is the relationship between the trading entity, which is the exchange, the JSE, with Strait, and the impact that this has on market users, and particularly in an environment of an SRO model, whether it's appropriate or not. Those two words are very short two words which give effect to a whole much broader range of questions and issues which we have begun to unpack but will not appropriately be dealt with in terms of this bill. That forms part of that market infrastructure SRO review process which needs to happen and is intended to begin as soon as this bill is passed and will be integrated with the Twin Peaks reforms over the next 2 years. And then moving on to code of conduct. A code of conduct was, in terms of the May bill, intended or provided for users of the market infrastructure, and it was very clear as to who was subject to a code of conduct, and there were certain omissions there, and the comment came through that why are there only certain regulated persons subject to the code of conduct, which we broadly agree with, and we agree that any regulated person, we should be able to impose a code of conduct if that is appropriate. It should be noted, however, that what we don't want to do is impose duplication on any regulated person. So, for an example, an exchange, we hadn't provided for a code of conduct, but actually in terms of its functions, those functions that it must perform in order to be a licensed as an exchange are much more onerous than a code of conduct could ever be. However, we note that there is the potential that over time maybe elements of conduct could emerge that are not captured yet as a function, and the registrar would want to impose additional requirements, and therefore this section provides for that. It should also be read together with the new 5.2, which is that minister power to declare a new entity or a different entity to be a regulated person. And what this means is that if you've got, I'll use again the CFD market, who are not captured anywhere else in the legislation or under the law, the minister can now say, well, you CFD players, you must be regulated, you are now a regulated person, and under this code of conduct provision, you would then be able to impose a code of conduct for those named entities or persons. Just generally what that's intended to mean is that how you should read that new regulated person provision under the Section 5 together with the IDB provisions, together with these provisions, is it's filling the gaps. It's picking out those entities which could fall between the cracks, and we're saying we don't want anyone to fall between the cracks. We need to be able to have full coverage in terms of the legislation. On Section 77, that was of the April bill. I think the bill had been tabled in April and then was released for public comment in May. That Section 77 has been moved to Section 5, as I already alluded to improve drafting. And then on the nominee section, there isn't a note on the slide here, but there was a question around and I think I have already discussed this, but just to make sure, that only approved nominees are accepted in terms of this legislation. That is correct, yes, only approved nominees are accepted in terms of this legislation. The concern, though, was for nominees of certificated securities outside of the DMAT framework, and there were practical problems with this, and there has been alignment with the Companies Act to make sure that we don't have that problem going forward. Moving on then to market abuse. On the insider trading, and I'll speak broadly to the insider trading and then the other prohibited practices. Really, under the market abuse sections, one needs to consider the following. Firstly, what is insider trading, and when is it another prohibited offence? And if you do contravene, when exactly do you trigger an infringement? And the issue here was whether you knew you were conducting that offence, whether you knew you were insider trading, or whether you should have known you were insider trading. And then lastly, if you have been found to contravene, what then is your punishment or sanction? Now, on the insider trading provisions, the concern here was that initially we had said firstly, what we've done is we've extended from the SSA that it's not only you as an entity who's insider trading, it's also that you are conducting a transaction on behalf of somebody else. You can still be trapped within that insider trading contravention. However, the concern was that it's a criminal offence, but at the same time we had this really onerous requirement that you should have known, and it was seen that was overly onerous. What we've said now is that it remains a criminal offence, but because it is a criminal offence, it's only if you did know that you were insider trading. The safe harbour provision remains. The safe harbour provision, there were concerns that it was overly loose, and there was a question around whether it allowed for cartel-like behaviour. We don't agree with that. We don't think that is the case. That the safe harbour provisions have been tightened up, but what it is intended to do is for example, where you have a merger transaction and you've got entities that or persons that are involved in that merger transaction and are needing to affect the transaction, they can't be triggering the insider trading contravention, and therefore you do need, under certain circumstances, that safe harbour. There were questions around the penalty for insider trading initially, and there's been a lot of discussion around whether it's only a combination or multiple of profit versus some other amount. The problem with it only being a multiple of profit is that sometimes you might trade on inside information but make no profit, and so the proposal of an amount up to $1 million is intended to address that. And that then you will see as one of the changes. So it can be the profit and an amount up to $1 million. Looking into the prohibited, that's a lot of detail, which is basically going to say that for other prohibited practices, these are not criminal offences. These are your administrative offences, penalties, and subject to administrative penalties. And as a result of that, they will be subject to a reasonableness test. You should have known. You ought to have known that what you were doing was a prohibitive practice. So there's a lower standard applied for these contraventions relative to the insider trading provision. And we think that is sensible and appropriate. Auditing, nothing, no changes. And then lastly, Chapter 12, the curatorship provisions, I think that should read curatorship of banks. There are various provisions that deal with curatorship, and there were concerns raised that these unintentionally, I should note, captured the process regarding banks as well as the South African Reserve Bank, and as a result, these entities have been carved out from these provisions. because that they are dealt with in very specific way, in a very specific way under different legislation and appropriately so. Regulations, this is a new provision to deal with the transparency, at least for the audience here, in terms of how regulations are issued. This is particularly important given the increased role of the minister in issuing regulations in terms of this bill. That role is necessary given the large and significant policy impact of many of what those provisions are intended to do, and this clause then assists with understanding and accountability in the way that those regulations are issued. Offences and penalties, Section 109, disclosure of confidential information is criminalised. This highlights the importance of making sure that confidential information is kept confidential, and the considerable impact if this is not abided by. And lastly, there was a concern or issues raised around high-frequency trading and whether this should be accommodated within the legislative framework. I think this is a very specific behaviour which is not appropriately, which should not be dealt with explicitly in the bill. What a bill should do is give the flexibility and the enabling framework where the likes of high-frequency trading, amongst many other types of concerning behaviour, can be dealt with. To single out high-frequency trading over and above or separate from other types of behaviour would be misleading and inappropriate, so it is not dealt with exclusively in the bill. However, an enabling framework is adequately provided in terms of the under the trading and the understood sections. So thank you very much. Just to conclude, I would like to thank the Treasury and FSB work group for their extremely hard work in sticking to the deadlines, as we have tried to do, and going through, as you can see, fairly dense material. Also to the open and solid engagement that we've been having with other stakeholders as well, and it has been what we consider a highly productive process. Thank you.
I just want to also just alert you to one or two issues, because I think by the time we come next week, there may just be some updates on this. I think firstly, just we are talking to the JSE and to the banks. There is just some concern about the way we're wording, is it 40, on the clearinghouse provision, 46, and the assets that you have and resources that that are there and whether that's done within the country or outside, because often these derivative contracts are, you know, cleared in the US. The JSE, in fact, may even send it to me something now, but we are, I think we've solved most of the issues, but just wanted to flag there's an issue there that we do need to, we're trying to resolve to the satisfaction of all the parties involved. That's both the banks and the JSE. Just a second point, and I think that it's a dilemma that we've been put into. We would generally prefer that even when the minister has the power to regulate, I mean, that on the one hand, these powers are onerous in many instances. On the other hand, you want to just have sufficient checks and balances. And often when a minister prescribes, it's got to go through a process, but that's not always exercised. And that's why I think sometimes we would have preferred that the regulators do some of those things. So I don't know how best we can proceed on this. So, for example, if you look at Clause 5, as we've put it, obviously there are categories of people who aren't registered or regulated. Those that are regulated we can act against. But then those that begin to act in the space without being regulated, how do you act against them? And this industry is so fast moving that often new trends, new issues come up to be regulated, like Cathy's pointed out in these contracts for differences. How do you actually regulate those? And I think that just generally as a practice, what we'd want is sometimes if you exercise those powers, there should be sufficient checks and balances if you are affecting legal rights of institutions needlessly, because you could, let's say, if you're reckless, wipe off billions just like that, okay, which is not what you want. And on the other hand, I think to ensure that some of these things should at least be legislated then within a period of 3 years if you're exercising those options. Now, certainly when we're looking at Twin Peaks, those are the issues we're looking at. That on the one hand, there's no doubt with the financial crisis that between the minister and regulators, they need to have sometimes draconian and real emergency powers to act. There needs to be checks and balances, and you need to then legislate at least after the fact so that at least this is done transparently. It's a dilemma that not only we are sitting with, this is an international issue, that the sector moves so fast, moves faster than any legislation, and how do you actually deal with this? So in some countries the regulators are very, very powerful. In our system, I think the power to issue subordinate legislation resides with the minister, and it's the regulators who will issue directives and so on. It's something that I think we still, to be honest, I mean, I think we're solving it in this case, but which is something that we need to look at going forward, especially as we come with the Twin Peaks legislation. I also think that, you know, there are a few other small issues here and there that we deal with, but that we'd come back to you when you have the bill next week, when we go through clause by clause. But I think what we've given you is largely almost the final version, but I wanted to just alert you to these specific areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Momo and your team. Congrats, Roy, for your confirmed appointment. But I know it's not a new terrain, isn't it? Nothing exotic. So you have been in this field, you know the dynamics. I gave you more time deliberately because I wanted you to exhaust your presentation. And I think you have managed, I mean, to in your presentation to elicit some of the reasons as to why things have been handled the way they have been handled, but also responses, I mean, as emerging from the public hearings. And I think that will help, I mean, the committee to obviously provide an adequate analysis and finally conclude on this bill. Members, I'm going to allow before we break, I'm going to allow, because as you know, we agreed that I want to say Advocate Jenkins. Advocate Jenkins, you know, you are becoming more of a member to this committee now. I get confused at times. That's why I am tempted at times to address you as Honorable. Advocate Jenkins, just to give, because in our earlier engagement, we agreed that we must work jointly, and that has been, of course, highlighted by the previous presenters that happened. Now, we just want to make sure that everything has been taken care of in terms of the legal consideration. Over to you, Honorable Advocate Jenkins.
Okay, I'll use this one. This one is working. This one is not. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, members, colleagues. I think my comments on the Financial Markets Bill is almost a result of my comments on the Credit Rating Services Bill. The issues of delegated powers to the Minister and the publication and the role of Parliament in scrutinizing those have been taken up. The other issues, the constitutional issues that you asked me to look at, in a piece of legislation establishing a regulatory framework, there almost inevitably there are issues of privacy that are being limited, search and seizure or inspection provisions. I've looked at those. I haven't found any unconstitutional issues or constitutional concerns. What I have found is that there's, much like the Constitution in Section 36 requires to have proportionality, it must be reasonable and justifiable. I found those there. So I have no real concerns. There are certain drafting issues, typographical issues, that I am discussing still with Janine, but that's not it's not a constitutional issue. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Momo, we will be eagerly waiting for your sound advice on how I'm going to deal with the cited dilemma, because it borders also on our mandate as parliamentarians in terms of ensuring that we don't get surprises. We don't get surprises. We really want to be on top of the truth in terms of regulation provision. Members, we are going to take a tea break for 10 minutes. Could we please be back at, let's say, 11:05 for us to obviously take questions and point for discussions before we get to our next presentation. Thank you very much.